What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Anyway, she goes to bed. I open up a box of Barbers. I light up. I pour myself a cognac. And I watch the 14 fists of McCluskey. What a picture.
Yo, homie, is that my briefcase?
And start asking the right fucking questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Rum and Rant, or in Australia right now, Roast and Rant. It's very early in the morning, so it's coffee time. Thank you so much for subscribing to One Heat Minute Productions Patreon podcast. Increasingly, we're having great conversations here about all sorts of movies. And what I wanted to do is, rather than enlist two of my great friends to talk on any number of my other shows, I just threw it out there to talk about one of my favorite movies of all time, probably in a little kind of mini series about it, because I don't think there's any possible way that you can cover this movie in any qualitative way without many conversations about it. So I've enlisted two of my great friends, the great Jordan Harper, now author, who's got two books out in 6 months, less than 6 months.
Me and Cormac McCarthy, we're having the same kind of year.
What a year it is. And my great friend, Jen Johans from Watch with Jen podcast, great film critic, filmintuition.com. Go check out like more writing than is humanly possible on cinema. Hello, Jen.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. So today we're talking about a film that we all three of us have loved. And I actually forgot that we hadn't podcasted about this movie, but it was just a catch up we had with our pandemic movie club where we watched No Country for Old Men and then we talked about it. And then one of my deep regrets was like, I didn't record that. That was great. It was like one of our best conversations we ever had. So I really wanted to talk about what is probably sacrilege to say, but maybe my favorite movie of 2007 over David Fincher's Zodiac, which is the Coen brothers adaptation of Cormac McCarthy's book, No Country for Old Men. And I just think that every single frame of this movie is perfect. Every time I watch it, I am blown away about the details. Every new side character and what they say, you know, beer leads to more beer, or, you know, it's the dismal tide. Like, it's not even, I've gone so far beyond the holy trinity of this movie with Tommy Lee Jones, Ed, Tom Bell, Javier Bardem's Anton Chigurh, and Josh Brolin's Llewelyn Moss, it's just a special movie. What did you guys think of it? Jordan, I know you're a huge fan of, obviously, Cormac McCarthy and this film, but when you saw it, what was your reaction to it? Had you experienced the book before you saw it?
I had. I'd read the book, and I love the book. I think it's you know, sort of the apogee of a thing that I love to see people, you know, not transcend the genre of a thriller or a crime thriller, but embody it to this fullness of telling this amazing story while also grappling with these enormous questions that Cormac McCarthy grapples with. And I walked into this movie believing, as I still do, that the Coen brothers are really underrated as filmmakers. And walking out of it, thinking that they really deserve to be in the conversation as the greatest filmmakers of their generation, at least American. And I don't know if it's like the fact that they insist on being funny a lot of the times that keeps them out of that conversation, that they get pushed into like a quirky box. But you want to, and I mean, there's a million things to talk about in this movie. Just rewatching it, finishing it this morning, there is every move, every cut, every sound, every laugh, is intentional and masterful. I just like, you know, just throw two random things. I noticed this time just how beautifully they compact the violence is when Chigurh invades the hotel room with the cartel guys. And, you know, he shoots somebody, and then in the shattered glass, the mirror of the bathroom swings open so you can see the hand of somebody hiding in the shower. And you don't need a separate cut. You don't need a zoom in. It's just, there it is. You see it, he sees it, and we're in. And I mean, in a totally different direction, you talk about the amazing performances. And this is maybe my favorite Garrett Dillahunt outside of
Yes. Hell's Bells.
Hell's Bells. Are,
differences, you know, Jen's favorite line. Yes. Whoa, differences, Jen's favorite line. But whenever whenever there's controversy, I just want to say, for the fans, whenever there's any kind of controversy, Jen is very quick to pull, whoa, differences. And I love that she does. I love that it's a go-to. It's so good.
There's
Jed Ayers loves it too. Oh my gosh.
Jed Ayers is Garrett Dillahunt in this movie. Like, can we say that?
I think that's right.
That's pretty fair.
I'm glad you brought up the shower, because this time around I was realizing the only moment of kindness that he has, or if you can call it kindness, that Chigurh has, is he closes the shower curtain for a moment before he kills the guy. And that's the only time we see any kind of empathy. I don't know if it's a professional respect or what it is, or if it's just so he doesn't get the blowback.
That's how I've always seen it. He literally and figuratively closes that guy's curtain. You know, there's a moment, you guys had said this to me, and I actually saved it. I didn't want to mention it. We've been talking back and forth in preparation for talking on this. There's a scene in that great motel, and Chigurh goes into his room first, and he goes into room 130, and Josh Brolin's Wella Moss goes into room 138, and then eventually 38 behind it to retrieve the case that he's stuffed into the... do you have a map of the rooms? It's got two double beds. But he goes into that room first, and I'd never noticed. When he walks into the room, he opens his bathroom, because he wants a room that has an identical layout.
Yes, he does.
To 138. Mm-hmm. Of course I've watched this movie 1,000 times, but in this particular moment I hadn't like cottoned on to this specific touch where he looks around the corner and he looks around the door and he's just, and then he walks over to the cupboard and he puts his hands against the cupboard to see how thick the wall is, because he knows that if I was hiding in this room, I would hide there. So I'm going to walk in. And he blows that guy away. Then he blows away the cupboard, because he knows that if I shoot through with my shotgun, it's gonna wipe out if anyone is actually hiding there. And then the guy reveals himself in the bathroom and obviously gets blown away and all those other events that happen. But just that touch, there's a beautiful, again, one of the best
like
shot
blood
movie.
Simple,
yeah,
almost.
Yeah, he just goes and touches his hands together and between this really thin, crappy hotel, cheap ass processed wood, and he just kind of touches it and is like, yeah, I know this will, I could blow this away with my gigantic shotgun with a silencer on it. But it's just like, he's just like, yep, he just tests, gauges the wood, and then enacts his plan. It's I was equally blown away. Jen, tell me about the first time you saw No Country for Old Men.
I watched it 3 times in the theater. I was completely blown away by this movie. I remember I don't think I wrote about it the first time. I took notes like as soon as I was done. This is actually the first piece I ever wrote that was quoted in The Guardian. So it was the first thing I wrote that ever kind of got some traction, was writing about this movie and, you know, what it meant to me as an American, because I was getting quoted, you know, about this country's hard on people, and also what it meant about masculinity and the way that Chigurh and the Brolin character, Llewellyn, are kind of like very linked. And so I loved seeing that play out over the 3 viewings. And I noticed every time I went back, I saw something different. I think the sound design the second time I saw it was like what really stood out, the thwap that you hear, you know, like when Anton does what he does, but also just some of the weird choices that the Coens make in linking those characters, like the fact that hold still is a line that is spoken both by Chigurh and Llewellyn very early on, if not the first thing they we hear them say, or it's one of the first things. And just the way that sound is used really came through the second time. The third time I saw it was really funny because it was after it had just won Best Picture. And I went with my dad, and, you know, the film ends and there was just like dead silence in the theater. And I was seeing it in an area with a lot of senior citizens. And so this woman stood up and just loudly started shouting, "This won Best Picture. Do you believe it? This won Best Picture. This." And she just kept going on and like getting, like working herself up, and everybody was kind of walking around her like, "Don't disturb the crazy woman." And my dad is kind of one of those guys. And so we start passing her and he's like, "So Jen, this is the third time you see it because you love it so much." And this woman just like glares at me. And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to get into a fight about No Country for Old Men. And, you know, it's the closest I think I've ever felt to shit could happen right now.
Yeah, I'm going to find a senior citizen.
Yes.
It's just Ed's dad. That's who she is. Ed's dad just sitting there. "How you doing?" you're looking at it, you know. She's got some wild cats and she lives alone on a frontier. She's not into something anything kind of highfalutin and exciting and then contemplative at the same time. I've told this story many times. I had a wild couple of days in the cinema in which I saw There'll Be Blood, No Country for Old Men, Michael Clayton, and The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford in two days.
Wow.
Wow.
At Sydney's main theater, it was on a holiday from university. It was like a break, uni break. I went along and I caught this double feature or quadruple feature over a couple of days. And I went, movies can't do anything else. I'm not sure what else movies can do after today. Cause like I'd had my first day was Assassination of Michael Clayton. And then the next day was There'll Be Blood and No Country. And I walked out post-traumatic stress. Like I walked out, I was just bewildered. It was amazing. So I loved it from the very minute I saw it, and I think I've always thought that it's perfect. And Jordan, to go back, the Coens are probably the best American filmmakers. It's almost inarguable that they're the best American filmmakers. They're pound for pound, film for film. Like their resume is unbelievable. To have Raising Arizona, Fargo, Big Lebowski, No Country all on your resume.
Miller's Crossing.
Oh my God, Miller's Crossing. It is wild. It's wild.
Well, yeah. And not only that, but they write, direct, and edit and produce all of them. They are, they're working in tandem, but it just makes me mad. Like, you know, somebody who dedicates my life to one of those four things that, like, I mean, to have lines, I talk about Miller's Crossing, which for years and years and years was my favorite Coen Brothers movie, probably supplanted by this, but. You know,
they're
just
neck and neck for me too.
Yeah, I have moments like that with the Coens, which I love this movie. I have a tattoo of Anton Chigurh on my body. We can get into that. But when I watch The Big Lebowski, I don't feel more joy than when I'm watching The Big Lebowski. And then I watch Fargo and I'm like, this is the best movie ever made. I don't know what to do.
You know, just these throwaway lines from Miller's Crossing, like, "So you want to kill him," for starters. Like just, you know, little things like that they just do. And then they go and they direct and they sound, you know, they produce, they edit under a pseudonym, like the
Roderick James,
and that they can do funny movies and that they can do, you know, genre send ups and they can do this and they can do Fargo and they can do The Big Lebowski. It's unreal. It's absolutely unreal.
Yeah.
They were royalty where I'm from in Minnesota. Oh. You know, we were so proud of them. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk really quickly because I remembered this conversation. There's a terrific friends of the show, the Light the Fuse podcast boys who do the Mission Impossible podcast, have like one of the best interviews with Robert Elswit that exists. Robert Elswit, the great cinematographer of a whole bunch of Paul Thomas Anderson movies, Oliver Stone movies, you name it. One of the great cinematographers of all time, actually was shooting a movie in the same region that No Country for Old Men was shooting, which is There Will Be Blood. And he was talking about his friend, his old buddy who now has his own podcast, Roger Deakins. And he was just going, they were shooting the breeze about this, you know, contemporary action stuff where you've got multicam and you're, you know, you're cutting between hyper stylized editing, but you're cutting between like lots of cameras that are moving at the same time. And Elswit, you know, work with Oliver Stone, so he's not unfamiliar with using like six cameras and cutting between them. And Roger Deakins is like, no, one camera, compose the shot, and that's it. That's what you do. And and I think that that's what struck me in this movie, is that the compositions and the stillness, they're not just they're not just flowery artistic framing for the sake of it. They're just so deliberately and stunningly composed, just little streets to orient the characters. And then the happy accident of that amazing shot as Llewellyn is running across the prairie, and in the background lightning strikes. It's like, this might, two of my favorite shots ever have lightning strikes in the background. And this is one of them. The other one is in Miami Vice, in the middle of a rooftop conversation. Sonny goes, meanwhile, and in the background, this lightning strike happens, this thunder, and the sky lights up, and you're like, how many takes did they do to get the lightning strike? You know, like, how do they even, you know, how they do it? But Llewellyn, especially in a mid-action shot, you're running away, and literally the movie is about a storm coming, and there's a storm coming in the background. I'm just like, that is just like, talk about osmosis. And yeah, everything about this movie, every shot of this movie gets me. But I think what is an underrated shot in my mind is when Anton grabs that cop that picks him up on the side of the road and takes him into the station at the beginning of the film, and you see his like primal, like animalistic, you know, strangulation of this guy and eventual murder. The face that he pulls, and you see the flailing of their boots and the leather striking the vinyl floor. I just am like, that is just one of the most gloriously composed, designed, executed, performed, terrifying shots that just says everyone is in trouble. Like, everyone in this movie is in so much trouble right from the beginning. He's sitting in a cop station. Usually that's like, we caught the bad guy, we can be relieved now. And it's,
he even says, I have it under control.
Got under control.
Right after that. Yep.
I believe he says in the book, I mean, it's an interior thought, that when Anton Chigurh takes the handcuffs from behind him to in front of him, that it was a move he had practiced many times, so that he was like, you know, this was just a thing that he would do, you know, in anticipation of getting arrested. How he got arrested, why he let this guy put cuffs on him, is a different question that is unanswered, but that's fine. There's, you know, that's how terrifying he is, that that he just practices for this moment, and then no doubt, no hesitation. It's, you know, he just walks right up to the guy and does it. It's not like he doesn't stand behind him for a beat. It's just,
and you love that he's out of focus. You just see his huge frame, and he just casually, and then he stands up and he's like, yeah, got it under control, Sheriff. Yeah. And then just straight onto the floor.
Yes.
Oh, so brilliant. It's, I remember in Oz, because it came out in the States a little bit earlier, the buzz about Javier Bardem was instantaneous. It was like, this guy's going to be and this is the most boring, for the record, the most boring fucking conversation in movies. And I'm sorry if you have to ply your wares and make your living at it, but the Oscar conversation, it's the most boring. It's the most boring. I'm sorry. If you're a professional out there and you're doing it, love to you, brother. Like, or sister, if you have to do it, you got to do it. I don't, you know, if you're making a living for your family, do it. But if you're a punter, just don't talk to me. Okay. It's the most boring shit of all time. Let's watch sports. That's what sports is for.
I don't even watch the Oscars anymore.
No.
Anyway, we're going to move past it. But I just remember that people said that was an iconic performance instantaneously. It was massive. And it needed to be recognized as this huge powerhouse performance. And then you get to the movie and you're like, yeah, he's amazing. And the movie is absolutely custom designed for him to excel. And he does in such a way that is so strange and so unexpected. There's no hugeness you expect with some of these Oscar performances, that it's going to be really large and overstated and crazy. And
monologue heavy. Yeah.
But it's just completely centered and utterly psychopathic. And then you see Josh Brolin and you're like, is he not also amazing? And then you see Tommy Lee Jones and you're like, is Tommy Lee Jones the best American actor? Like, is he? Just his one face, the way in the scenes, especially that he has with Garrett Dillahunt in the cafe, when they're sort of like talking about different things and you're watching the emotion go on his face and he's just like tiny tones that he makes with like one eyebrow movement and a pursed lip and a furrow of a brow and then a thought. And I'm like, all of these guys are just...
Woody Harrelson too.
Woody Harrelson is so good in this movie.
Yes.
Compared to what?
I love the WH sound. Compared to what?
I feel like maybe we had this conversation when we did our film club conversation about this, but I really feel like we have not gotten as much out of Woody Harrelson as we could have. That I feel like, he's fucking amazing. And, you know, I think, you know, maybe he blew some of his really great performances on movies that I love, but not everybody does, like Natural Born Killers. You know, I will argue, not to talk about True Detective in any meaningful way, but that he is the thing that carries that season one of True Detective.
Yeah.
And he is the guy doing the work of keeping anything sane in that TV show grounded so that Matthew McConaughey can spin off into space. But like,
Jordan, I know Harrelson
has a harder job.
I know you love when I bring in random phrases that are Australian and sometimes sport related. We talked about Farm Strong recently together and you're like, I like that. There's a phrase in Australian rugby league that has been popularized by a group of guys who identify as punters and dribblers. So they dribble about sport, you know, bet on it and they dribble. And they say about forwards who do all the thankless work where they just run hard and get tackled hard and they just have to work hard all game. They call it truck and nut. Where you basically get the ball and you run and you do all the thankless shit that is so essential to how your team wins, but you never get any of the plaudits. And I feel like Woody Harrelson is truck and nut for that series. Like he is just, he's doing all the story, like all the, and then you're allowed to have Rustin Cole. He delivers the rest of the series on a platter for Matt McConaughey because he's doing such hard work being that thankless shitbag character and just owning it and being amazing. But you don't get the movie without him. You don't get the show without him. He's incredible. And he's delicious.
Well, and he's sitting across from Steven Root. I mean, you just talk about like it's a bottomless cast. I do want to go back because I don't think I had an earlier thought of things I noticed this time around. And I brought up Garrett Dillahunt, but I didn't say what it was that I think is his best line delivery isn't even a word. It's a laugh. And it's when Tom Bell, right? That's his Ed.
Yeah.
Tom Bell.
Yeah.
Is describing the serial killer couple in California.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
California, and how, you know, it took a man being run out in a dog collar for anybody to notice. It has that great line about, I don't know why they tortured him. Maybe the TV was broke. Yeah. And then said, you know, nobody cared when they were digging graves in the backyard. And Garrett Dillahunt laughs. And it's this like laughter of despair just like how awful the world is. And all you can do is laugh. It's such a good little like, he's amazing.
More than one fracas. I like that one too. Yeah.
But he, you know, again, I think he's been later in his career slotted into comedy. I'm excited. He's in the new season of Hightown.
Cool.
Unfortunately, I wrote the single episode in the season that he did not appear in.
Son of a bitch.
I'm very upset about. I wrote some stuff in other episodes, but my one credited thing that I did, he's not in, which bums me out. But anyway, he's, you know, he's so amazing in this. And then, you know, you can just run down the roster of, there's not
Kelly
a bad McDonald.
Performance. Kelly
McDonald and Scottish actor.
Scottish
mm-hmm. actor doing the best accent work of anyone who's ever done an accent in a movie.
It's
like
really
people
good.
Like people are like, wait, that's the Trainspotting chick? You're like, yeah, it is. She's doing the best accent I've ever seen. Yeah. Like, it's just impossible. How did she do that? I have no idea how she did that.
Oh, yeah. She's great.
Yeah.
I'm going to take you in the back and screw you.
Big talk.
Big talk. She's the best.
Yeah.
But,
I love that he never lies to his wife. Neither one. Both him and Ed Tom Bell, they don't want to lie to their wives.
No, they don't mm-hmm.
And so every time he asks, or every time Kelly McDonald's character asks Llewellyn a question, he tells her, you know, where'd you get the gun? At the getting place, you know, and bag full of money, you know, satchel full of money.
That'd be the day.
Yes. And so I love that neither one of them wants to lie to their wives. And I think that's a really sweet thing about the movie that people don't talk about.
I love Ed Tom Bell's wife. Loretta, Tess Harper, who's amazing as well. She's phenomenal. Just a great character actor. She's in a million things. And she's like,
no,
don't get hurt.
Movies.
I won't. Yeah. Da, da, da. And then the last line is, now don't kill anyone. And he looks at her and he goes, you say so. He gets in the car. I'm just like, oh, God. I can't get enough. I cannot get enough of this movie. And this is the thing. I was trying to just figure the runtime. Because obviously someone who examines things sometimes incrementally, I get obsessed with how long things take.
Never.
But it's 2 hours and it feels like it's 15 minutes. It's miraculous. And it's so still. And so you would think that, oh, there might be a pause, a beat, or something. But even Llewellyn, like, stalking across the border bridge where he's really badly hurt from a couple of glancing blows with glass and bullets coming after him, but particularly the one that like that pierced rib shot from the blown out door lock. And I remember thinking, I was trying to register the beats of the movie about, oh, is this a moment where it sort of slows down or it doesn't feel like it's moving? But even that scene is so insanely tense. All the way to cross the border, even though you kind of feel like Anton's gone, he's in the wind, he's done a wangro and he's disappeared into the blackness, and you know he can hide in the shadows because he is the shadows. But then he stalks across the bridge, and it just is so tense, and it's like, oh my God, you lean into the screen, like, is he going to make it? Is he going to get arrested? Like, what's going to happen? And I that's another minor miracle of this movie is that despite how deliberate everything is, it's so well paced that it just moves, even when it's someone stalking around a car park, and how slowly Anton uses the little transponder to like beep 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 and like find the right room and go back and forth. It's just, I love also the pacing of this movie so much, everything about it.
The scene you just mentioned with the bridge and the boys, I had never noticed this time that the nice one in the group who's like, you know, just give them the beer, or the nice one actually looks like the nice kid at the end of the movie. They are almost like a younger version of the same guy. And I think the shirt even was similar, or there was a lot in those two scenes that I was realizing were parallel this time that I guess I hadn't put together before, with Anton in the car crash, and then Brolin also the line, you know, were you in a car accident? Yeah. And it's like, oh, later that guy is. Yeah.
I did notice there were two shots of both of them taking their socks off.
Yeah. And doing DIY surgery. Both of them do their great DIY surgery scenes in this.
This is something I noticed this time, and this is taking this tack a little far, maybe. But I really was thinking about the Vietnam War a lot while watching this one, because it comes up. You know, this is a period piece, and the Vietnam War comes up several times, and the fact that Llewellyn was a soldier for two tours in Vietnam, and the entire thesis of the movie, or at least from Ed Tom, who is a reactionary and has a ridiculous conversation with the other sheriff about how the world's falling apart, they got green hair, stop saying sir and ma'am, about this idea that there's some invading evil force that cannot be comprehended and comes in and just sweeps everything out of the way. And that these men are presented as like a alternative to that, or a bulwark against that. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, if you were to film a Vietnam movie from the point of view of a Vietnamese person, that the tables would be completely turned, and that this invasion out of nowhere of this unstoppable, implacable force that cannot be reckoned with, cannot be stopped, and is coming for them. I don't know. I thought it was really interesting, and I don't know, exactly where Cormac McCarthy would come down on something like that. But I think his position of America as an agent of war is very well established. And
oh yeah.
I don't know. I just thought that Llewellyn even gets back in the country because of the fact that he went to Vietnam and suddenly is respected by this border guy who, is maintaining our borders, but if somebody else, went overseas and did something, then great, bring him back in.
I think you're spot on. I've always thought of it as he uses Vietnam as like, we're such an international force, and we are caring about our colonial footprint, but the thing that we're ignoring is the war that's on our border. Like, the most important border in the United States is this southern border, where on one side of the fence we seem to have laws and we seem to have these things, and yet on the other side of the fence, even though it's not lawless, but it's like the conflict of these two cultures bashing against each other, really the same, the same kind of people that came from Europe, predominantly took over indigenous populations, incorporated them into their worlds, and the conflicts of their cultural differences that are right there. And again, people who might look at the United States and go, oh, well, we're a bastion of democratic values. Couldn't possibly be as corrupt as the Mexican government and their ingratiation with the cartels. It's like, oh, maybe you guys have got better publicists, but it's all the same shit. Like, it's all, and I think that border town conflict is always like, we should stop. It's, I think it's his way of, again, this movie's very interior. I've always thought of it as like the way that he interiorized, like, you have to look at home. This is, this is our war at home. This is our war with ourselves. And I don't think he otherizes the cartel stuff. He's just like, this is the actual war. This is the conflict. This is the place that we should be focusing our attention, not militarily, but like, why are we killing each other for these drugs? Like, right here at the border, like, because it's not like the cartels don't have customers in the United States. That's the point. The point is that there's all this fighting and things, and we're just deflecting all of our need for drugs and all the things that we're consuming, and we're allowing a war to be taking place on our borderlands for our satisfaction, I guess.
The other thing that always kind of fascinates me when I watch, I think what you guys were saying was brilliant and spot on for sure with Vietnam and what it's saying about the cartels and the war on drugs and all of that. But I'm always fascinated by the idea of free will versus fate.
Yeah.
And what this movie is saying, you can't stop what's coming. And then there's the question of, is it a flip of the coin, or is it really the person deciding what happens with the flip of the coin? Was that car going to crash into him anyway? There are so many different questions that come into this movie. I think this would be, when I was going to film school, there was a really cool unit in one of my classes on foreign film on existentialism. And we would watch movies like, Three Colors Red, and ask questions about free will versus fate. And I think this movie would be a fascinating one, because you had to write a paper after to sort of like, what do you think this film is saying? And I think you could argue it either way. And I love that.
Yeah, I agree.
I do think, you know, Llewellyn particularly is somebody who, to me, is choosing what happens a lot more than he lets on.
Yeah.
And wants what is happening to happen a lot more than he lets on.
Yes. And
it only goes awry when he realizes he's not going to get what he thinks he should get out of it, which is a showdown, mm-hmm. You know, a fair fight. You know, that he makes a lot of choices. I don't know.
He's owed a bit. Yeah.
He's like, and he doesn't
deserve it. Yes.
But he doesn't care about the money. I really don't think he does.
I think it's just, you know, I found it and this is what we're doing. And this is my decision now. And I'm following it through.
Yeah. Right. And his decision to keep going ahead when there were a lot of opportunities for him.
Oh yeah.
Not to go ahead.
Yeah.
It never really occurred to me before that, because he plays it so matter of factly when he leaves a wounded man to die.
Yes.
And then later on goes to give him water, and you're supposed to, I think you kind of go, oh good. It turns out he's a good guy. He's going to give this guy water 10 hours later.
Yeah.
But he could have just at that moment said, well, here's a living human being who needs help, and walk that guy to the hospital.
Yeah.
And he does not do that. He goes and chases after the money. And he
might have sealed his death warrant right there a little bit, if you're talking about karma. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he goes hunting, or after he's in the war, and what is being said?
It's the missed shot. He misses mm-hmm. the shot, and it's only when he sees the convergence of the two blood smears.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, mm-hmm. one's dry, one's fresh, and he looks over and sees that dog hobbling away.
And not just a dog, but like, and the Coen brothers are not very heavy-handed in this movie, but it is a black dog. Like that is a symbol. That is a symbol that means do not involve yourself with mm-hmm. this.
Yeah.
And
then he goes and finds Ultima Hombre. Ultima Hombre. Where's the last man?
There must
standing?
Have been one. Yeah.
It's I didn't reread the book in anticipation of this, but I was thinking about it. And so my memories might be a little faulty, but you know, I was thinking about things that get left out. You know, Anton Chigurh in the book is much more business minded than he is in this, and doesn't just come in to kill Stephen Root for revenge, but goes in to like say, I'm going to be your like branch manager of the cartel at this point. Like it's like a takeover play, which he's actually actively gathering power instead of just chasing the money, which again, there's never any point where you think Anton Chigurh wants $2 million so he can become the character from The Counselor. Like, I don't think like that's what is being suggested.
Get himself a tiger or something. Yes.
He comes off as more supernatural in the film and more like, more like Judge Holden from Blood Meridian. Then
different point in time, complete with the haircut.
But I don't know, so I thought that was an interesting and correct choice to kind of up the, he's not quite supernatural again like Judge Holden. He sure doesn't seem human, but there's never anything that you could point at and say, see, this proves that he's not human, but he's clearly mm-hmm. a force.
But he and Llewellyn are in it for the match. That's what's so interesting. Like, Llewellyn is like, the fact that he's being tested, that's what's a thing that really gets me with this movie, is that they're like, you know, even though Ed Tom Bell's like, I feel overmatched, he's not overmatched. He maybe is a slower step, but his thinking is so exactly right that he's the only one that even gets close to Anton. Like, actually, they're a doorway. They're a shitty, cheap wooden doorway away from each other, looking at the internal socket reflections of one another at the end of this movie before he goes and checks Llewellyn's room. And they almost both have to agree not to to have a confrontation at that moment, because they both can not only can they feel, they can sort of see this abstraction of one another, this abstract reflection of one another right there. And the fact that he's lost a step is the only reason that he doesn't keep going, but it's the fact that he gets chased down and Llewellyn lasts. It's like he's fulfilling something that's been vacant in his life of like the chase, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever I watch this movie again, I'm like, as soon as Llewellyn is in this situation, it kind of awakens something that is very, you know, to your point about Vietnam, Jordan, it's very interesting. It's like he was living his highest, in his mind, his highest form of existence at that time, you know, maybe in Vietnam reflectively. Yeah, like a mission. And when he encounters Anton, it's a very formidable mission. He has to be operating at such a high level that it's very interesting. And the same with Ed Tom Bell. Like he's, you know, he's the guy with Garrett Dillahunt's Wendell. Oh, Wendell. Is just like completely bewildered by everything. And Ed's like, no, we've got to go here and we've got to go there. And I don't need to go back out to that crime scene. We need to try and get ahead of this. And he doesn't have to say any of those things that are obvious in that. He just, it happens. It's coming out of his pores, you know?
You know, I have, when I talk about this movie, I've come to find that I have a much more pessimistic reading of it than most people. And a lot of it for me, to jump ahead a little bit, comes down to the very last line of the film, which is also the very last line of the book, if I recall, where Ed Tom tells the story about the dream of his father and his father is carrying the flame ahead and, you know, lighting the darkness. And it always seemed to me that to end that story with, and then I woke up, is to me like this profound admission that, that was a dream, that was a lie. There is no light being carried on in the darkness.
I agree with you.
And I've also always felt like a lot of that comes from the fact that he doesn't go and confront Shigur in that moment, that, that this is in fact no country for old men, that he is not capable and like does not put his soul at hazard at the end of the day. And the rest of the film, that long ending after the shootout, second hotel shootout, I guess you would say, third hotel shootout of the film, where Llewellyn dies. And then, you know, there's the long aftermath is Ed Tom trying to reckon with the failures that he has. And he goes and visits the old timer and he, you know, fails to save Llewellyn's wife. Although he's not actively trying to do it, he does also not do it, you know?
He just promises he will not harm her man, but he doesn't. He tries, but.
So I'm glad to hear you agree with me, Jen, because ran into a lot
Jordan,
of people who...
I read that too. I don't know how you can't have, like, even if you had not quite all the way pessimistic, it's just a pragmatic view of the world.
Yes.
That's what's refreshing. It's refreshing pragmatism. The world is not, it doesn't owe you anything. And if you think that someone's just going to come in and be the white hat and save you, that's not what this is. That's not what this is.
Also the setting at 1980.
Yeah.
Like we're done with Vietnam, but you know, the sins of the past and what's coming.
Yeah. They just don't know that it's Ronald Reagan is what's coming.
Exactly.
it's a really, really dark film. And you know, you talk about the woman who hated the film. A lot of people did. And how many of them hated it before Llewellyn died would be a question I would be interested in.
Yeah,
that would be interesting. I know a lot of people were really angry about the car crash with Shigur. I think they wanted to see Shigur pay for
perish. And even I love that even in that moment, because that Llewellyn death is one of the most shocking deaths ever in cinema for me, especially the fact that it happens essentially off screen and you just see the fallout.
I think that's important that it happens off screen.
Which it essentially does in the book as well, by the way. It's not portrayed in the book. In fact, I recall having to go back and read a paragraph twice going, wait, what? But go ahead. I'm sorry.
No,
anticlimactic showdown.
Yeah. Yes. There's no showdown. And then when Shigur does get hit by a car, it's almost like that's the funny Coen brothers. Mm-hmm. Like that he would actually die in that moment getting like clobbered by an old man who runs a red light. Because it is like then, but then he just gets up.
Yep.
And just walks on out of there. And you're like.
Just like Llewellyn.
It's just like, okay.
Well, but he, you know, except for that, he just really will never stop is the message. I think, you know, again, not to be
he
reductive.
He can take all comers, which is the line that Kelly MacDonald has. Yeah.
But, you know, the line at the end of Blood Meridian of he's dancing and they say that he is dancing still, I think is what you're supposed to get out of Segura at the end of that is that no.
That's
bone poking out of arm. He's still going. He's going to. Yep.
The Energizer Bunny.
Yeah, he'll go and get that compound fracture corrected, and and all will be well.
Just blow up another car, start a distraction.
I really don't want to see him do that DIY surgery. That would be too full on. I hope he goes to some form of veterinarian or something. You know, someone to set a bone. We don't have enough time. We don't have enough time to continue this conversation. So I'm gonna pump the brakes here. People are going to get like 50 minutes of us talking. I'm going to arrange a follow-up because I feel like we didn't even scratch the surface, and I could talk about this movie with you guys forever. So we're going to have to pump the brakes. We're going to have to let Jordan go back to writing his follow-up to Everybody Knows. I'm sorry to tell you that. We're going to have to go back to Jen producing one of the best and most comprehensive podcast series and getting nagged by me occasionally about a massive project that we're going to undertake together. Then we're going to have to come back and talk more about this movie because we haven't even talked about Carla Jean's mother. We haven't talked about
Liz Manny.
We haven't talked about
Sheriff Bell's. I am old.
They're in the bag,
Mama.
I am
not well. Yeah.
It's not often you see a Mexican in a suit. We didn't even get to that. So we have so much more to go. And we'll be back to talking about The Dismal Tide in another episode soon.